EAA Radio, broadcasting the spirit of aviation around the globe.
What's significant about December 17th? The Wright brothers' first flight. It's also the date that Jeff and Barb Skiles got married 26 years ago. Congratulations on your anniversary and celebrating with us. As was mentioned earlier, Jim and Dolores Skiles, Jeff's parents, are here, and we welcome you. And Jim and Dolores are both pilots and share with me their flights to Alaska that they took with Jeff and the boys and so forth, and what got Jeff interested in flying. Do most of you remember what you were doing back in January when 1549 landed in the Hudson? I do. It's one of those incidents that you don't forget what you were doing, what was going on. And little did I think at that time I'd have a chance to meet the crew, Jeff and Sully, to engage them in their involvement in EAA, and to be able to honor them here tonight, Jeff Skiles. Had a chance to spend some time with Jeff and Barb in Madison shortly after the accident. And 4 hours later walked away totally enamored with what he shared. The experiences, how it's changed his life. But more importantly, it's not what Jeff and Sully did on that day in January. It's how they've represented the aviation community since then. They've been the epitome of professionalism, of experience, teamwork, focus, performing in stressful conditions. It was a time when this country needed good news, needed heroes. When you use that word, Jeff shies away from it. But as was said at the table just a few minutes ago, this was a situation where average citizens were doing their job to the utmost and performed far above and beyond the call of duty. It's an intriguing story. What makes it so is because it was so successful. We could spend hours asking questions and hearing the recount or the retell. But unfortunately, we can't do that. But we're going to hear firsthand from one of the Hughes in the Hudson, a professional aviator, co-chairman of your Young Eagles program, and EA member. Let's welcome Jeff Skiles.
Good evening. You know, tonight we meet here to celebrate the anniversary of the Wright brothers' first powered flight. As Tom said, on December 17th, 1903, Orville Wright piloted the first powered airplane. They flew 20 feet over the windswept beaches at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. His first flight lasted 12 seconds and covered 120 feet. But by the end of that day, Wilbur had piloted a flight that was 59 seconds long and traversed almost a quarter mile. Now, the Wrights, of course, are world famous for being the first to successfully fly a powered airplane. And I see it as somewhat ironic that I seem to have become at least semi-famous for not being able to do any of that. But like many things, when you do it in a big enough and dramatic enough fashion, just about any failure can become a success. Certainly landing a plane in a river, 10 blocks from the home of every major media news network, is going to put you in the news. If you want media, you have to come to them. Now, while we all share a common kinship with the Wright brothers, you know, I share a bit more. Their shortest flight was 12 seconds. Mine was 5.5 minutes. Mine went a little farther, but it's still a crosstown subway ride from where I started. And in September 1905, Orville was the first pilot to hit a bird. I wasn't the first or the last, unfortunately. But tonight, I'm going to tell you my bird story. Orville can tell you his. Now I'm going to do that by putting you on the jump seat. Jump seat is a special place, and only special people get to ride there. It folds out from the side of the hall that in the entrance to any cockpit. It's right between the captain and the first officer. You have to be on a national database of people to even ride there. And if you don't already know about it, you'll never be able to ride there. Today I'm going to put you in the jump seat. I'm going to bring you along with us over the Hudson River on January 15th by telling you my story. Now, as you sit there, to the left, you have Chesley Sullenberger. He's a rather official, serious-looking man, unusually so for an airline pilot. And he grew up in Texas, where he learned how to fly and went to the Air Force Academy. He flew F-4 Phantoms in the Air Force. He, after his military hitch, he got hired by Pacific Southwest Airlines, which is one of the airlines that later became U.S. Airways. To your right is me. I was a civilian pilot. My first job was pumping gas at the airport, and I got my licenses and flight instructor while I went to college, flew for a couple smaller airlines, and I was hired by U.S. Airways, U.S. Air then, in 1986. The Airbus is the fifth airplane type I've flown there. I've been a captain there, but I like having my days off when I want them off more than I like the money, so I fly as a first officer. Now, as Tom said, everybody seems to remember where they were on January 15th. I don't know if you remember where you were, but I know where I was. Now, we'd started that day in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We flew down to Charlotte, and we switched airplanes. And we're going to go up to LaGuardia. Now, LaGuardia had low clouds, and it was snowing. And if you know anything about LaGuardia, that means air traffic control delay. So we're sitting in Charlotte at the end of the runway in the holding pad with the engine shut down, waiting for our wheels uptime. And I'm asking Sully what there is to do on the West Coast, because I haven't flown an airplane that flew west of Kansas City in 20 years. So I'm saying, what do we do in San Diego? What's there to do in Los Angeles, San Francisco? These are exotic places to me. And he starts, ironically, telling me about this place in Seattle. It's called Kenmore Aviation. It's only about a 20-minute walk from the hotel. And you can go, they fly these float planes out to the San Juan Islands, up to Victoria, Vancouver. And they'll let you jump seat. There's not actually a jump seat there, but if there's an empty seat, they'll let you ride along for free. Well, I am really excited about this. On the back of my trip sheet, I'm writing down the name of the person you call, getting the phone number from them, because I have never landed on water before. I still haven't got out there, but somehow it doesn't seem so important anymore. Now, by the time you join us, it's clear and it's cold. We have a full flight, 150 passengers in the back. And at the gate, you see Sully and I accomplishing our flows. We go through the cockpit in a very organized fashion, making sure every switch is switched, every light is turned on, every computer is loaded properly. And then we do our checklists. Taxiing away from the gate, Sully's taxiing the airplane, and it's my job to put in the weight and balance in the computers, talk to the ground controllers, set the controls for takeoff, get our speeds. This is the last day of a four-day trip for us. In fact, it's the last leg of that day. When we get to Charlotte, we're all going to get to go home. Sully lives near San Francisco. I obviously live in Madison, Wisconsin. And the flight attendants live in Winston, in Asheville, and in Pittsburgh. I've just been released from training. The week before, I did a trip with a flight instructor, which is the last thing you do after you get out of training on a new airplane. And this is my very first trip with a line pilot. Not only is it my very first flight in a new airplane, it's also my first flight in Charlotte, and it's my first flight with Sully. I had just met him for the first time the Monday before, 3 days, when he stuck his hand through the cockpit door and, you know, said, "Hi, I'm Sully." Now we're holding short at the end of the runway. It's going to be my leg. The pilots swap legs, and you're either the pilot flying or the pilot monitoring, depending on what your role is. We're cleared into position and hold, and Sully taxis the airplane out, lines up with the center line. I put my feet up on the brakes, and he says, "Your aircraft." And I say, "My aircraft." The air traffic controller clears us for takeoff. I bring the thrust levers up to about 50% power, let them stabilize, and then three clicks forward into the TOGA detent, which is takeoff go around. The airplane starts to accelerate down the runway. Sully makes sure that the engine's accelerated the way they're supposed to. He says, "TOGA set." He calls out 80 knots, V1, rotate. And I pull back on the side stick, which is how you fly an Airbus. It's like an F-16. It's got a little side stick, which I am not at all used to. And we leave the runway. At 400 feet, we roll to north and start our accelerate. Now, by now, it's become a nice day. It's not like any other day in my flying career. You can see forever after the cold front is pushed through. The clouds and the snow are now off to the east. In fact, Sully looks up the Hudson River, which is actually quite beautiful, towards West Point, and he says, "What a view of the Hudson today." Well, we'd be seeing it up close in about 4 minutes. As we climb out, we raise our gear and flaps and accelerate. At 3,000 feet, I'm pitching the nose over to accelerate to our 250-knot speed limit below 10,000 feet. And at that moment, I catch a glimpse of a line of geese. And I'm shocked because they're so close. And then Sully says, "Birds." And I remember being shocked, but then feeling this great sense of relief because I thought we were going to fly over the top of them, which we did in the cockpit. But they hit the airplane like hail. There were multiple thuds as they ricocheted off the fuselage, the wings, and the engines. And then both engines immediately lost thrust. The shock of it was like having a bad cold. It felt like your head swelled to twice its size and you were looking at the world through a fog. Now we've got the nose up and we've suddenly lost all thrust. You can just feel the airplane decelerate in the air. I'm pushing the nose forward, and at this point, Sully decides he's going to take over the airplane. And he says, "My aircraft." And I said, "Your aircraft." After all, clearly I haven't been doing that good so far. Now, I've had 4 engine failures in my career so far. I managed to double my total in one flight. Now, these engines, they're only tested to withstand a 4-pound bird at 200 knots and not catastrophically self-destruct, which means they don't have an uncontained failure and fly apart. But they're not actually certified to continue to run after even adjusting a Sparrow. I have gotten cards and letters from people who have their own ideas on bird protection devices for engines. One came and he had a very nice drawing of an airplane with what looked like these giant fly swatters out in front of the engines. I'm sure that, you know, patents are pending. Now we're gliding. We're at just over 200 knots of airspeed and we're losing about 1,000 feet a minute, but we're only at 3,000 feet to start with. The right engine is turning at a very low sub-idle speed, and the left engine is better, but it's not producing any thrust. This flock of birds was so big that it painted on the air traffic control radar. We got the opportunity to see the plot when we listened to the cockpit voice recorder tapes. And they showed up as a bunch of little purple dots. And you could see our airplane take off and fly right through the formation, take out the center of the formation, and it looked to me like some of them actually turned and followed us for a while. Now, I always thought that they were geese, just by the 1 second that I saw them before we hit them. But they sent the remains off to the Smithsonian Institute for forensic analysis. And they positively identified them as Canada geese. And I want you to know that I used to say Canadian geese. But a couple months ago, I was talking to a group of a group that contained a couple of Air Canada pilots, and they came up to me afterwards and said, "You know, great presentation, but you call them Canadian geese. They're Canada geese. When you say Canadian geese, it makes it sound like we put them there." Now, back in the cabin, the flight attendants know that there's something wrong. They're not hearing any engine noise. They heard the impact of the birds, and it's so quiet they're whispering to each other on the jump seat. Sheila said it was like a library. And she's the only flight attendant that's visible to the passengers, and they're actually trained in this, and they know that they have to remain calm, because if the passengers think there's something wrong, the first person they're going to look for is a crew member. Now, the passengers, they know something's wrong. They heard the birds thudding against the airplane. They look out and they see flames shooting out the back of the engines on their side as they compressor stall. But mostly they thought that, okay, this engine's bad, but we're going to return and we're going to land on the other engine. Up in the cockpit, I reach for my quick reference handbook. It's a book of emergency procedures. And ironically, I did this very procedure 2 weeks before in the simulator. But this book is an over 100-page book. And this is a 3-page checklist, which is designed to be done at about 30,000 feet if you ingest volcanic ash and the engines quit. It's not meant to be done at 3,000 feet in 3 minutes' time. But still, the cockpit voice recorder said I managed to overcome the shock of hitting the birds, find my checklist, find my reading glasses, get to the right page and start reading the checklist in 20 seconds. When I was able to go over and fly the Airbus A380 a couple months ago in Toulouse, the Airbus test pilots told me that when they were simulating the event, they were never able to start the checklist as fast or to get as far in it as I did in the time that I had. I told them I had a reason to be motivated. Now, Sully's calling Mayday, 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 and the air traffic controller, Patrick Harton, turns us to 220 degrees, which lines us up with the Hudson River. I'm resetting a computer to get our speed information back, making sure we have electrics and hydraulics, and actually trying to restart the engines. Now, Sully's talking about going to LaGuardia with Patrick Harton, the air traffic controller, and I can't see LaGuardia because it's on his side of the airplane, so I can't make any judgment there myself. Our only options are go to LaGuardia, to Teterboro Airport in New Jersey, or to land in the Hudson River. All we're seeing is skyscrapers, roads, and houses. This is obviously a very congested urban area. If you could find a highway long enough, you could land on it, but not here. There's no place to land. Now, the air traffic controller stopped all departures at LaGuardia and Teterboro and cleared all the airspace for our distressed aircraft. And he was actually an excellent air traffic controller. He tried not to be too demanding. He was very quick. He was a real hero. When he called up Teterboro to tell him to stop all departures and clear their airspace, he even left the phone off the hook and just set it down on his console so the Teterboro controller could hear everything that was going on. Now, Sully's talking to the air traffic controller. In an emergency, the flying pilot often talks. It's less distracting for him. Now, we're losing altitude rapidly. Patrick Harton points out Teterboro at 2 o'clock, and I'm looking at it, and it doesn't look good to me. And Sully agrees. The Hudson River becomes our choice for landing. It's broad, it's flat, and if we strike off across land to somewhere, we have to know that we're going to make it. Now, while I'm accomplishing my checklist, I just keep telling myself that this can't be happening to me. I'm going to wake up from this dream. One of these engines is going to restart. What I remember most about that descent to the river was the noise. We have all manner of oral alerts for things in modern airline cockpits, and I think every one of them was going off. We were getting what we call GPWS alerts, which is a constant whoop, whoop, pull up from the radar. Reflecting off of the skyscrapers. We're getting traffic alerts from some helicopter that was coming up the river. We're getting too low gear, too low flap call-outs. The alert bell was sounding continuously as our ECAM was getting cascading failures that were just overwhelming the monitoring systems. Sully has the presence of mind reach back and pick up the PA and give the brace for impact command to the passengers. The flight attendants immediately start into their emergency procedures. They chant, brace, brace, heads down, stay down, over and over and over again. Now the passengers know their fate, and they handled it in many ways. Some of them texting loved ones, some of them writing notes to those that they leave behind to put in their shirt pockets. A couple people I came to know here at EAA, Army Captain Andrew Gray and Stephanie King. Andrew Gray was just back from two tours of duty in Afghanistan, and he was engaged to be married to Stephanie King, who was from West Bend. They kiss, they tell each other, I love you, and Andrew's the son of a minister, so they pray together. Barb and I had the honor of attending their wedding a couple months ago. Now, we had to start slowing this airplane down. We're going too fast, and it would break apart at this speed. So we get the flaps out, but we leave the gear up. Now, at about 1,000 feet in the air, it's pretty obvious that we're not going to get an engine to restart. We're going to have to ditch. So I start calling out airspeeds and altitudes. Now, Sully needs to land the airplane with the wings perfectly level to avoid digging a wingtip and cartwheeling the airplane. But fortunately, the river is very calm, and there, at this very moment, there really isn't much boat traffic. As the airplane blinked off the radar screen, Patrick Hartnan, our air traffic controller, thought to himself that he would never talk to anyone on that airplane again. But, you know, even in dire situations like this, there are moments of levity. When we listened to the cockpit voice recorder tapes, we heard something we never remembered from the actual event. Right before we touched down in the river, Sully says, got any other ideas? And I said, actually, no. I remember this odd sensation of, like, you know, the skyscrapers rising up around my ears on the left and the bluffs of New Jersey off of the right. We hit hard on the tail, and then the river just seemed to flow over the airplane as water cascaded on the windshield. But then it popped up, and we were just bobbing in the waves. I turned to Sully and said, well, that wasn't so bad. I know I've made worse landings. And as you all know, any landing you can walk away from is a good one. We needed a boat. The airplane had lost all electrical power when the APU ingested water, so Sully has to get up to actually command the evacuation because our PA doesn't work. And I stayed behind in the cockpit to shut down some systems and do an evacuation checklist. The flight attendants don't even know that we've landed in water until they open the doors and see the river. But they instantly change their commands to don life vests, come this way. Now, the landing was pretty severe in back, but it didn't feel that way up front. But the belly had ripped out of the airplane and the tail was filling with water. The passengers rushed to the back to the tail, and I think so much weight going back there dipped the tail into the water momentarily because some of them said the water was up to their necks. But Doreen managed to get them headed forward to go to the overwing exits. Now, by the time I go back, the passengers are rapidly exiting the airplane. Probably the first 10 rows were already gone, and they were in their rafts in the front. And you know, sometimes your fellow travelers aren't always the best and the brightest. But I'm immediately faced with this, I don't know, 25-year-old guy running up the aisle wearing nothing but boxer shorts and socks. I mean, it's January. It's 20 degrees. They wouldn't have let him on the airplane like that. I later found out that it was his idea that he was going to swim to shore. So he took off all his clothes. Well, I guess we should count ourselves lucky he left the boxer shorts on. Of course, by now he's realized how foolish this was, because he's freezing, so he's shivering, and he's looking at me. He says, "What do I do?" I said, "Get in the raft." So we had a couple people sit on top of him to keep him warm. Well, I helped the last of the passengers off, and then we went back to about the mid-cabin to get life vests, because they hang underneath the seats, and nobody knows that they're there. Now, the water was up to my knees, and it was just freezing cold. Any part of your body that was in that water just ached to the bone. Both Sully and I started walking on the armrests and the seats just to keep our legs out of the water, but you still had to reach down underneath into that freezing cold water to get the life vests. Now, the rear slide rafts were unusable. So, as you saw, a lot of the passengers had to stand on the wings in that literally freezing cold weather, or water, excuse me. And the wings were slippery with jet fuel, so people were sliding off the wings into the water, and they'd have to help to get them back on. And initially, the water was about ankle high, but as one of the wings dipped down into the river and the other one came out of the water, some people were up to their waists standing on the wings in that water. But the great success of the rescue was the passengers themselves. These were professional passengers. These were commuters, people who work in New York City but live elsewhere, and this was a Thursday afternoon commuter flight. There was only one family on board. In fact, eight of them were so unfazed by the whole experience that when we finally got to a ferry terminal, they hung around for a while, saw that there was no point in staying here, so they went out to the cab, hailed a cab out, or went out to the curb, hailed a cab out to LaGuardia, and they were on the next flight out to Charlotte. Now, back in the cabin, the plane was filling up with water. But I was no more than about 20 feet from those overwing exits, so I figured I could swim for it if it suddenly decided to sink. And after a while, I mean, we got all the life vests we could get. There was nobody left in the airplane, so Sully said, "Let's get out of here." So we went up and got our life vests, which we'd never put on, and then went out the what we call the 1L door. It's the door you normally board the airplane through. Now, I remember the sense of it was so calm in the airplane because there was nobody there. And then when we get out into the raft, it's just absolute pandemonium out on the river. We were already surrounded by boats, and more boats were coming. There was a helicopter overhead dropping a frogman into the water, and it was just kicking up spray and just freezing everybody. In our raft were Sully and I and Donna, one of the flight attendants, and everybody was just wet and cold. I managed to cut the tether holding our raft to the airplane, and we floated around the nose of the airplane, and we were all set to get picked up by this nice low-bolt boat, one that we could just crawl into. But then this big passenger ferry comes barreling in there, pushes that boat out of the way, and he decides he's going to be the one to rescue us. And it's about 8 feet up to the deck on this thing. It's just another obstacle. They throw down a boarding net. And I remember looking at this thing, staring up at this deck, and thinking, what is this, D-Day? My hands are absolutely frozen. I can't even move my fingers anymore. They throw down a rope, and I'm kind of holding in my elbow just to keep the raft next to the boat while the passengers climb up the net. And it really didn't seem like much time at all, and I hear Sully behind me. He says, "Jeff, we better get out of here while we still can." And I look around, and the raft's empty. I read in the paper where we're part of the harbor cruise now in New York City. They take the tourists out there, they show them an 8-minute video, and then they all line the rail and they gaze upon the waters where it happened. Now, once on the boat, a passenger lends me his phone. He's got one of those flip phones, and I walked in to, you know, where it was warm, and he's just flicking it shut, and he looks at me and he offers it to me. And, you know, my phone was in the river. So I thought, well, I probably ought to call my wife. But, you know, do you ever dial the phone and you don't know what you're going to say until the person answers? Well, I'm sitting there, I'm staring out the windows at the airplane. People are still on the wings, they haven't been rescued yet. And I dialed it with my knuckle because I couldn't move my fingers. And she answers, and she says, "Hi." And I said, "Hi, this is Jeff." And she says, hi. And I said, I don't think I'm going to be home tonight. And she says, why? And I don't know. The last few minutes haven't been going that well for me, you know? So, for some reason, I thought, I got to get off this phone as rapidly as possible. I don't know why. And I said, well, we took off from LaGuardia, we hit birds, we flamed out both engines, we ditched the airplane in the Hudson, we think we got everybody out okay, I'm okay, I gotta go. And I hung up. So then I hand the phone to Sully. He calls his wife, but they got caller ID. And she's talking to somebody. So she looks at it and she says, oh, it's just Sully. He'll call back later if it's important. So then he tries calling our dispatcher to tell him, you know, we just crashed their airplane and all. And he, in fact, answers. And he says, I don't have time to talk to you right now. We have an airplane down in the Hudson. Now, the last 20 minutes have been kind of, you know, action-packed for me. You know, and with the shock and the stress and the fact that the boat is rolling pretty good, I'm beginning to feel really sick. But fortunately, it's not long before we touch at the dock. The flight took 5.5 minutes, 2 minutes until we hit the geese, 3.5 minutes to land in the Hudson River. It took me over 5 times that long just to tell you about it. Now, we're at the ferry dock long enough for the politicians to arrive. Mayor Bloomberg and Governor Patterson have come out to hold a press conference on site as if they know anything about what happened. And this is where Governor Patterson coined the phrase, the miracle on the Hudson. Now, maybe it was a miracle. I don't know. I just have never thought it was that big a deal to me. You know, it's little enough to change a man's life, but yet it really has changed mine. As with everything, some things are good, some things are bad. It's not fun being interviewed on TV. I can still see Larry King in my sleep. The Super Bowl was all right, but I wouldn't have watched it if I was home. I usually lose all interest after the Packers fall out of the running, and I think that happened about the end of September last year. And I've met all manner of politicians. I can't say you're missing much if you haven't. But one of the incredibly positive things that happened for me about the last year was rediscovering something that I never should have lost. Something that I guess I always have known, yet I'd somehow forgotten. And that's that I like to fly airplanes. Now, being an airline pilot isn't any bed of roses these days. But as I've said many times, coming here to Oshkosh for AirVenture really changed the direction of my life. Now, as you know, Sully and I are the co-chairmen of the Young Eagles. But what you found out in September, we knew at AirVenture. I'd like to tell you how it happened. When I first got here, the very first night, after the Doobie Brothers concert, I was in a reception at the Ford tent, and I was talking to some people. One of them happened to be Greg Herrick, who apparently was in charge of, or at least is instrumental in getting the auction items for the Young Eagles auctions. And I happened to mention to him that I was thinking of auctioning off my shoes on eBay just to see what they'd get. And he says, you wouldn't think of donating those to the Young Eagles, would you? And I said, it's a crummy pair of shoes. And he says, you do it? And I said, well, sure, if you want them. So, I mean, he was so excited, he ran off and got Tom Poberesny, and Tom Poberesny came back and said, what a great gesture for the youth of America. I said, it's a crummy pair of shoes. If it means that much to you, I'll throw in my leather jacket. Oh my God, they were apoplectic. So, comes the night of the actual event, And I think Sully and I said a few words, and then I said, and I have something I would like to add to the auction tonight. The shoes that I wore that day on the Miracle on the Hudson. They walked up and down the aisle in the water. They dried out on the heater at the Marriott Courtyard that night. So I'm thinking, I don't know. I'm sure I didn't pay more than $40 for them. I'm thinking, $250. Well, the bidding goes to $15,000. And I'd had it arranged with the auctioneer that when the bidding kind of tapered out, I was going to say, and that's what I did. I said, excuse me, I said, I have something to add to the auction. The leather jacket that I was wearing that afternoon. So people started asking, what size is it? You know, they said, put it on. So I, you know, put it on and pranced up and down here at this very place, just like some sort of runway model. And the bidding took off again. It went to $30,000. And then Alan MacArthur, who was the president of Airbus America, lost all common sense, hopped up on the stage and said that they would match the highest offer. So it finally ended up at $38,000. So with Airbus's match, that was $76,000 for the Young Eagles for what's probably a $40 pair of shoes and a leather jacket I know I bought for $99 at JCPenney. Well, apparently the powers that be at EAA just lost their head when they saw that about my obviously rainmaker status as a fundraiser. The cry of sold had not even stopped reverberating through this very hall when Harrison Ford and Jack Pelton dragged us off the stage, took us to the side, and they said, "We want you to be the new co-chairman of the Young Eagles." I didn't have to think twice before saying yes. And I got to tell you, I am really excited about working with the EAA and with the Young Eagles and working with all of you. Now, of course, this experience has made me a little lighter in the wallet. Not long after AirVenture, I decided that if I was going to be the Young Eagles co-chairman, I probably ought to have an airplane to fly Young Eagles in. It all seemed very logical and proper to me at the time. And what's most surprising is that my wife seemed to agree. Whereupon I discovered another axiom of aviation. When you're willing to spend large amounts of money, there's no shortage of people willing to help you do it. Now, my personal Pied Piper is a man named Larry Harmasinski. Now, he was actually a roommate of mine 30 years ago when we flew for a cargo outfit in Omaha, Nebraska. But I kind of fallen out of touch with him over the years. But I really became reacquainted with him here at Oshkosh at AirVenture. Because every time I managed to escape from Tom, which was not often, I could be found down at Larry's Waco in antique camping, where he and his wife Ilse were camped for the entire week. Of course, I just had to mention the possibility of buying an airplane to Larry, and he was scouring all of Waco land to find me one. He did, and he convinced me that it was a great deal. But I hadn't completely lost, you know, my financial senses. I decided that it would be prudent to find out how much it would cost to insure a 1935 antique made of sticks and fabric. You know, particularly for a guy that's fresh off a crash of a $100 million airplane. You know, as with all things in aviation, I've now learned that when it comes to price, it's best not to ask. But I was still young and naive. This was 4 months ago. So I called up a couple insurance agents for quotes, and one of them who I called up was Bob Mackey from Falcon Insurance right here in Oshkosh. He's here in the audience tonight. And you know how when you call up insurance agents, you know, they get the, and you want to quote, and they get that kind of disinterested tone in their voice, you know, you can just imagine them grabbing your legal pad, getting their pencil. Okay, what's your name? Address? What kind of license you got? What sort of airplane you want to insure? Any incidents, accidents, or major hull losses in the last 5 years? Well, you know, it's amazing the quality of the connection with these modern fiber optic phone cables. I could hear the groan all the way down in Madison. I could just picture him up here going, God, why do these guys call me? But he did fix me up, made me promise that my duck hunting days were over. So now I'm all set. I meet up with Larry. Remember my costly friend Larry? I meet up with Larry in Allentown, Pennsylvania to pick up my new old airplane. And on the flight back to Wisconsin, I had the first opportunity to be true to my pledge to Bob about no duck hunting. Put that to the test right away. We're flying over Ohio near Mount Vernon. And of course, a Waco is a whole lot slower than an Airbus. So I'm in the left seat, Larry's in the right, and he looks out ahead and he says, Bird! And I'm looking out there and thinking, oh, yeah, I think it's a hawk. And then there Larry says, Bird! And then all of a sudden I realize, oh, geez, I own this airplane. Now, being me does have some advantages. My airplane, I come to find, was once owned by somebody who was very famous in the antique world named R.J. Hardin. Now, I've never met R.J. Hardin, and R.J. hasn't owned the airplane in 23 years. But people will regularly come up to it, walk around it, look at it, and say, isn't this R.J.'s airplane? Now, so prevalent is this that I've come to understand that no matter how famous I am, November Charlie 15244 will never be Jeff's airplane. It will forever be RJ's airplane. Now, my understanding is that no one has seen or heard of RJ for decades. He sold everything and became a recluse in Colorado. At least that's the story I was told. But I was recently interviewed for the EAA Antique Online site. And in the interview, I kind of complained about how difficult the airplane was to land. It's rather difficult for a tail dragger. It's really more getting used to it, and I'm used to it now. And after a while, an email pops into my inbox. It's from RJ. He's giving me very welcome tips on how to land the airplane properly. I tried his suggestions and they work. But I'm getting instruction from a guy who hasn't even seen the airplane in a quarter of a century. After a while, I get in the mail from Robert Taylor of the Antique Airplane Association this magazine from 1969 in which RJ writes an article about what's his and my airplane. In it, he tells the story about how he was flying over Illinois and he lost all the oil in the airplane. So he had to make an emergency landing in Alton, Illinois. And on the landing, the airplane catches on fire. Well, they have a fire truck in Alton. So the fire truck runs out and it gets there just about the time as the airport manager. And apparently the airplane must have been pretty decrepit looking at that time because the airport manager hollers at RJ, is it insured? And RJ says, yes. And then he hollers at the fireman, let it burn. It's insured, let it burn. Well now, back here, you know, winter's approaching. And I need somewhere to keep my airplane. Not to worry, Larry has a plan. He convinces the lady who owns the hangar next to him to sell it to me. You know, my recollection is that people rent hangars, but not on Larry's home turf. Everything to do with Larry is expensive. At Broadhead, Wisconsin, you don't rent, you buy. You know, it occurs to me that I simply can't afford to have too many friends like Larry. Now my Waco, my hangar, and me are snowed in for the winter. But I'm looking forward to seeing you all next year, you know, in Oshkosh at AirVenture, if I can afford it. The one-year anniversary of the miracle on the Hudson is coming up fast. The passengers have a big event planned in New York City. And, you know, I wasn't really initially planning to go because, you know, I'm not much for looking over my shoulder. But it sounds like it's going to be quite a cavalcade of activities. They managed to line up Canada Goose piñatas. So as they say, we can all take a whack at them. When Sully returned to flying in September, you know, I of course joined him on his flight because I've been back qualified since April. And let me tell you, it was quite a media extravaganza. Press conferences, helicopters filming the event from the air. It was covered live on several news channels. But you know, after we chased all the cameramen out of the cockpit and we're going back to Charlotte and we're in cruise behind the locked door, you know, Sully asked me a curious question. You know, he said, "Jeff, you know, right after the event, you used to say that you just wanted your own old life back. If you had a choice, would you do it again?" You know, I thought about it a little. You know, and I said, if I knew that I was going to live the life that I have led for the last year, and then it would all be over and tomorrow I would die, yeah, put me right back in that cockpit over the Hudson River. I'd do it all again without a thought. Now, that's the end of my presentation. But I want you to get used to our relationship and what it's going to be in the future. As the Young Eagles chairman, when you see me, I'm going to be looking for money. Now, as you file out of this room, there's going to be a table on your left, and it's going to have a number of magazines that are hand-numbered and signed by me, as the of the Dave Wyman's Midwest Flyer magazine. In it, there's going to be a number of articles about Amelia Earhart. Dave tried to get her signature. Didn't quite work out. And there's going to be a couple articles that Dave wrote about flying with me in my Waco, and one that I wrote about flying the Airbus A380. They're $25, and all $25 goes to the Young Eagles. They're great. You can tuck them under the tree. They roll up real nice to put in stockings. They're great for starting fires. And as we approach the end of the year, they are fully tax deductible. Now, there are only 100 hand-numbered copies, and they are limited, and any one purchaser is limited to 100. So you better hurry. I'd like to thank you for coming and listening to my presentation this evening on this 106th anniversary of the Wright Brothers' famous flight.
Let's have a big round of applause for Jeff Skiles.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks.
What we're going to do is, before we have a toast, we have a microphone in the audience, and if Jeff wouldn't mind to field a few questions.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, chance to get some insights. If anybody has a question I'd like to ask of Jeff, you put your hand up, we'll bring the microphone to you. There's a question right here.
Here we go.
Jeff, very much appreciated that presentation. It was great. When the engines went out, what time window did you feel that you probably had 20 seconds or 30 seconds where the engines went out for you to get into the Hudson? You know, what was that?
You mean between when the engines quit and when we ditched?
No, but in other words, the engines went out at a time that you could put it in the Hudson.
Right. How much longer would it have been?
Yes, right. If it had quit 10 seconds later, could have you still made the Hudson, or what was that window?
Yeah, I would imagine maybe at another minute or something. I mean, you know, I'll be the first one to tell you that everything went our way. I mean, other than the geese, of course. But, you know, other than that, we were extremely lucky. Everything from that, hitting those geese forward, it all went our way, and it had to.
Next question, on the left here.
Jeff, what kind of things did Airbus learn about the performance of their airplane in ditching, and did they make any changes in procedures or anything?
Well, they haven't made any changes in their procedures, but they discovered that it doesn't do what it's supposed to, what they thought it was going to do in ditching. I mean, there's a lot of technical things, but they thought you'd be able to get a higher pitch angle at a certain flap setting, and there'd probably be some changes in their in their certification of the airplane, I would imagine, out of this. But I don't really, I'll be honest with you, I'm not a groupie of my own crash, and a lot of people think you know everything about it, but really, you know, other than being there, I don't really know anything other than what you all have access to, which is what's in the papers and what's on TV. It's not like I have any inside information on anything.
Jeff, before we have the next question, real quick, you talked about the large cruise ship or tour ship that picked you up in the Hudson. What was the name of the captain?
Vince Lombardi. You know, and I asked him, I don't know, I guess everybody's named Vince Lombardi in New York City. Because I asked him, are you related to Vince Lombardi? He says, I am Vince Lombardi. I said, no, the football coach. I says, I don't know. I mean, it can't have been that many generations, but.
Next question.
Hi, Jeff, it's Don. I think the only mistake you ever made is leaving the 7-2.
Over 20 years ago, he was my captain on a Boeing 727.
Question up front here on the stage right.
Jeff, I'd just like to ask you, what flap setting did you actually use for the landing in the Hudson?
Well, on the Airbus, they're not degrees. It's just 1, 2, 3, yep, and full, and we were at flaps 2.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions?
Well, got one more? Okay, here we go.
Adam's getting their workout.
Keep me fit tonight.
Did Airbus modify their ditch list from 35,000 to maybe 5,000?
Well, actually, that's not their procedure. That's a company procedure, and they haven't done anything yet. But probably, I'm sure it'll happen. Well, everybody waits until the NTSB comes out with their final report on the incident, and that's probably going to be sometime in the spring, and then they'll make modifications based on that.
Okay, let's take one last question from Bob Lemoy.
Adam, if we could take one, there's one in the back. Take two more.
You go first. Jeff, what did you learn to fly in?
Cessna 150. I even remember 7796 uniform. Don't know why I remember that, but I do.
Is anybody in the audience own it today?
Question, have they put the tabs back on the emergency manual yet?
No. That was Sully's big thing, tabs on the emergency manual.
Well, Adam, if you'd come up here and join us, we're going to have a toast in a moment, but before doing so, again, Jeff, what we want to say is that we're extremely proud that you and Sully have accepted leadership of Young Eagles, but more importantly, we're extremely proud of how you've conducted yourself on behalf of the entire pilot community in terms of professionalism and representing aviation at a time when it's sorely needed. Maybe in conclusion, could you share a little bit about what you're doing now in terms of your work in Washington and safety and so forth, because you've covered a number of initiatives.
Oh, well, I foolishly got myself elected to a position as I'm the vice president of an organization called the Coalition Airline Pilots Associations, which kind of is a legislative arm and represents American Airlines, Southwest, U.S. Airways pilots, UPS pilots, NetJet pilots, basically I advocate for pilot issues in Washington right now. And I don't like it much, but I'd much rather be flying an airplane. Hoping to get back to that sometime soon.
Okay, as our regular attendees know, we like to end our program this evening by proposing a toast to the memory of the Wright brothers. And I'd like to ask a very special pair of guests that we have here this evening to come up on stage. We have Phil Haupt and his wife Becky, and they've traveled all the way here from California this evening. And on October 3rd of this year, on October 3rd of this year, Phil was flying some young eagles out there in California. And when the forms came through back here to Oshkosh, Phil was the pilot of the 1.5 millionth young eagle that has been flown since the program started in 1992. So I'd like to thank you both for coming all the way here to be with us this evening. And Phil is going to propose our toast to the Wright brothers. But before he does that, I do need to tell you what I think is a great story. Sometimes aviation breeds romance. And Phil was telling me that he proposed to his wife, Becky, using a banner-towing airplane, right? And it said, "Marry me, Becky?" question mark. And then the two of them actually got married on board an airplane. They were on a twin otter flying over the Golden Gate Bridge over San Francisco, and they were showing me photographs of that earlier. So that's a great aviation romance. I'm going to hand the mic over to Phil to propose our toast this evening.
Thank you for having us. We're delighted to be here. And it was at my wife's air show that I got lucky and I gave a kid an airplane ride. I think we never forget our first airplane ride. Everybody in this room remembers their first airplane ride. That's important. And I think that guy never forgot his first airplane ride either. And so here's to the Wright brothers and the first powered flight ever. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you very much, Phil, Becky, Tom. And most of all, to our wonderful guest speaker this evening, Jeff Skiles. He's good. He's very kindly agreed to sign some autographs if people want to come along at the end of the program. Go and get those Midwest Flyer magazines. There's only 100.
Can I just add something, just a moment, in conclusion? As you propose a toast to the Wright brothers, I'd like to propose a toast to all the EAAers here, and I'll tell you in just a moment why. The Wright brothers made it possible for us to be here. Someone asked the question, Jeff, what did you learn to fly in a Cessna 150? And when I look at what this organization has done, today I got a call from Mike Carricker, who was the test pilot on this 787 Dreamliner the other day, call to tell me about the flight, how proud he is to be an EA member, and that he's working on his kit fox in his garage. The test pilot for the A380 that was here, Terry Lutz, built an RV-6. You know, so the home building movement's alive and well, whether it's small airplanes or big airplanes in general aviation. So let's toast EA and what its contributions have been to aviation.
Well, thanks for being here, everyone. Have an absolutely wonderful Christmas. And as you drive home and as you fly your airplanes, watch out for those birds.